I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors, Dave Archer and John Hendrickson, and a former ARS colleague who's now working part-time for NDSU up at Williston, Don Tanaka, all been part of our cropping systems team at our research location in Mandan. It's an honor to be here. We hope that we can contribute something to this whole theme of diversification and intensification in the context of what we've been doing up at our Mandan location. And as you can tell by the subtitle, I've opted to take more of an insular approach to this talk. I'm going to just kind of focus on what we've been doing at the lab. And then arguably, I don't know if that's the right approach to go, but what the reason I took that approach is that when the invitation came, and it was February or March, at the time I was thinking a lot about the history of our research farm. We just celebrated the 30th anniversary of our Area 4 SED research farm, and it's where we concentrate a lot of our dry land cropping systems work. And I thought, well, okay, there's been some things that are going on that certainly apply to the theme of this symposium. Let's go ahead and give it a try. And we ended up publishing this paper in the Journal on Soilwater Conservation. I think the July issue kind of gave it a nice overview of the research and the outreach activities that we've done over the 30 years there at the farm. So where is this farm? This is about a 430-acre farm, just about 3 miles from our main research station, and that research station is the Northern Great Plains Research Laboratory. We are, as Alan said, we're Northern Great Plains. If you follow Glenn Padbury's map, we're in that Region 1 right there by the sort of the confluence of the Missouri and Hart Rivers. We are a semi-arid site. Most years, evaporation exceeds precipitation, but not always, okay? So we're kind of right on that subhuman line. It's about 410 millimeters on average. We're cold, as you might expect with North Dakota, and we enjoy a fairly lengthy growing season that seems to be increasing with time. We're blessed at the research station with some amazing soils. We're talking typical Pocklick haploostal, so there's really good inherent fertility as a function of the about 13,000 years of prairie that helped them develop over time. The lab itself is over 100 years old. We've always been focused on natural resource issues and have been part of the USDA ARS since, I think, 1953. Prior to that time, it was the Bureau of Plant Industry, and I think we were Division of Dryland Agriculture, if memory serves me correct. So dryland agriculture was really a key part of what the lab was about right from the get-go. As you might expect with a federal research lab, we've fluctuated in numbers over the years, but we've always tended to have a fairly diverse staff that complements one another, and that allows us to really do work that is relevant for farmers and ranchers in the region. And we have a very active customer focus group that always is providing good input and also making sure that we stay on task and things in terms of doing things that are relevant. Collaborate a fair bit with NDSU, but like a lot of ARS labs, our domain is not the state, but is rather the region. And so that allows us to work with cooperators in other states and also be influenced by other excellent research going on in neighboring states, as well as in other countries, Canada. And also we've had a chance to interact quite a bit with the folks in Western Australia, which has been really, really great. So anyway, all right, so that's the sort of the preamble of why I'm focusing on the lab. Now, what am I going to talk about here for the next 25 or so minutes? Well, I have the word evolution in the title of my talk, so that assumes some sort of chronosequence. And so what I've chosen to do first is let's look first at the future and what we might expect. And then we'll look back at the past of what we've learned at the research location, and then see, well, what's going on the landscape right now, and how can we potentially apply what we've learned in the past to deal with the challenges and opportunities of the future. So that's sort of the theme. So the future, and the future is always sort of a sketchy thing, because you really never know what's going to happen. So I've sort of have a disclaimer here from a philosopher from my junior high years. He happens to be a Jedi Knight, so I have to lean back. He's kind of sort of has my back in case things seem to be a little bit off base. But one thing that really comes to mind when we talk about the future, and Dr. Stewart already addressed this, is what's going on with respect to climate. And this year, as part of the National Climate Assessment, there's a series of reports that have come out on themes and also by region. And this particular chapter by Dennis Rajima and Mark Schaefer talking about what things we're going to see a mid-century caused by climate change in within the Great Plains region. And so I'll just sort of step through sort of a few of their highlights that they had in the chapter. And if you, I'm sure many of you have read it, but if you haven't, I encourage you to take a look at it because it's really good stuff, founded on I think very good science. So first precept, what might we expect with respect to the number of heavy precipitation days? And these are days where you have 2% or higher of the 2% of your precipitation, that's the highest amount. How is that going to shift? Well, generally across the entire Great Plains, there's not that big of a shift in that. But what we do see is a big shift in seasonality of when we're going to get that precipitation, particularly on the northern plains. What's going to happen is that they predict that by mid-century, a lot more of our precipitation is going to come in late winter, early spring in the form of rain. Okay, so we'll revisit this, but that's what kind of they're looking with respect to precip. Now, what about the dry days? Well, clearly longer days in the south, longer spells in the south, but really minimal change in the north. We still will get dry in the northern Great Plains, the northern portion of the Great Plains, but it's not going to be any more severe than it already is. What about temperatures? What about days exceeding 100 degrees Fahrenheit? Well, predicting four times more of those days in the south, two times in the north. And I think we, on average in Mandan, we're looking at 2 to 3 days per summer where we have temperatures over the over 100 degrees Fahrenheit, so we're looking to potentially double that. The big thing that caught me was that those nights greater than 80 degrees Fahrenheit, still, you know, same trend, four times greater in the south, two times in the north, but when you look at the length of that growing season, extending it by roughly 24, 25 days. And I look at this, and I look at that we're at 135 days, yeah, 24 to that. That's equivalent to my birthplace in Norfolk, Nebraska, about 600 miles away to the south. So that's quite a shift in sort of vegetation zones. Okay, so what might this mean? Well, there are certainly positives and negatives with respect to that. I mean, here in the northern plains, you're more winter precip, increase your water holding capacity, water availability in the early in the growing season. But at the same time, there are already parts of North Dakota that are far too wet to plant. Up in the Devil's Lake area, it's really difficult, and so there's a lot of prevent plant. We're going to have more of that in the future, and what might that mean for cropping systems? There's also potential for increased erosion and nutrient loss with that as well. Increased temperatures will certainly lengthen the growing season, okay? That might expand our options for cropping, but at the same time, then we might have more weeds, more insects. What is this going to do with respect to winter crops if they come out of dormancy and then we get a freeze? You know, how is that going to affect them? What can we do to adjust? And then on the livestock end, okay, well, there may be less stress for them during the winter because it'll be warmer, but there could be a lot more stress on them in the summertime. And so I don't know if that's a net negative. I'm not sure about that. But there's you know, two ways to look at it. And it's not just climate change. There are other things that are going on that we have to consider. I mean, since the mid-80s, there's been a huge push to, you know, of private companies of developing varieties of corn and soybean that are adapted for our region. It's just literally exploded up in North Dakota. I think the corn acres have risen by about four times since the late 80s, soybean acres seven times, and I go down to Nebraska quite a bit because that's where I'm from, and I can drive I-80, and I drive Interstate 94, and they often don't look that different. It's pretty amazing how much corn and soybeans we have, particularly east of the station. Well, you got all this corn, you got to figure out a way to fertilize it. We're having a $3 billion plant being built by CHS just about 100 miles east of us. And this is a tremendous amount of nitrogen that is going to be produced. And their marketing target is within a 200-mile radius. So there's a lot of reactive N in our future, potentially. There's also National Agriculture Genotyping Center. This is a center that's going to identify genetic traits, detect and monitor pathogens, and it's a collaboration between the National Corn Growers Association and Los Alamos Labs. And the corn growers have invested $32 million into this project. It's based in Fargo now, and it's intended to serve all crops, but there's, you know, given that it was part of the maize genome project, it's really going to have a really good tool, I think, for corn, which seems to be increasing in acreage quite a bit in our region. There's other considerations, the land use change. We've seen a lot of conversion, particularly in the Prairie Pothole region in North Dakota and South Dakota, being converted to crop production. And of course, then there's the big one, the Bakken oil field, which has really exploded since 2008. This is a lot different than the oil booms of the 1950s and 1980s. With the fracking technology, this is going to be around. And we're talking 2,000 wells per year, at least, for the next 20 years, with a lifetime extending into, you know, beyond 2100. So it's a multi-generation sort of effect. It's not going to go away. And there's all kinds of challenges to producers in the western part of the state. With respect to, I mean, there's grain transportation delays, there's issues of livestock health because of all the dust and so forth that's kicked up, and just simple logistics, moving machinery, hiring help. I mean, this is tough things to grapple with. And then on top of that, this whole Williston Basin where we have the oil and gas is also just overlays our Prairie Pothole region. So there's an ecological component here that's a major flyaway for our waterfowl. And they're kind of getting pushed on both ways, the land use change and this. So what does this mean? So pretty complex. Good place to be an ag researcher. There's a lot of challenges here. So, but at times you think, wow, boy, it'd sure be nice to be able to go back to a simpler time and look back, right? Maybe not sample by hand all the time, you know, but you know, we could start here with European agriculture, but it would be unfair to our native people. The Mandan, the Dasa, Arikara had an amazing agriculture that they practiced along the river bottoms. And they did it for hundreds of years. And they were really successful. Wilson, that's right, he was an anthropologist from the University of Minnesota. Early 1900s, he spent 3 years with Buffalo Bird Woman learning her planting techniques and how this worked and how they shifted cultivation. And you read this, it's a great read. I mean, and you find that there's a lot of practices that they were employing that are like taken right out of the conservation agriculture playbook. I mean, it really makes good sense. Right? But that supported at least 100,000 people between current day Fort Yates up to Washburn, but of course it didn't last, at least not to the same extent, because we have post-European settlement, agriculture moved up onto the uplands, started using machinery, using those fertile soils that developed under grasslands, and the lab that we're at work, and we were a big part of that, understanding how agriculture, dryland agriculture, would work in the region. And so we looked at a portfolio of crops that were relevant to the settlers at the time, and they were utilizing tillage and doing crop rotations, and they did this study for nearly 20 years, and they found out what you might expect when you're using tillage is that moisture retention is a big issue, and there are some issues with respect to erosion and soil fertility. Yeah. And in fact, it's interesting, you look at this report from 1936 by Sarvis and Thysel, go near the end and hear that what they're saying is like, this is a real sketchy place to do cropping, right? So, you know, go for a mixed type of farming, which is about what we're trying to do 80 years later, is integrated ag, you know, with livestock and crops. So. But the one thing that, you know, the cropping persisted because we started utilizing fallow, using that long period to capture precipitation. But, as Bobby's pointed out, the water use efficiency is not very good. We're losing a lot of water, and then you also have some pretty serious issues with respect to soil health. And you can look at the soil carbon numbers that Howard Haas generated from his samples he collected in the early 50s, and big drops in soil organic carbon. So with that, you know, if soil organic carbon goes, so does your soil health. So there were problems. Well, along comes some technology, okay? Weed and residue management technology, early 70s, and you begin seeing, well, we have an opportunity now to maybe, you know, we could create that mulch layer. There might be some opportunities where we can get a flex crop in there periodically. And then when no-till really starts to hone in that technology and we can get it perfected, that's about the 80s, now we can think about cropping annually. But there's a couple of different ways you can do that. Of course, there's the fixed rotation approach, and there's also a dynamic approach. I'll run through those. Well, what's fixed sequencing? Well, the fixed sequencing is the diversity of a fixed sequence is a function of how many crops there are in your portfolio. It may be two crops, popcorn beans, or it may be 5 or 7 or 9, as we have with some of our organic producers in North Dakota. So that diversity is a function of that. And there are clear agronomic, environmental, and economic benefits from going from, you know, going from eliminating fallow and going for annual cropping every year. That's quite clear. It's a lot of work that was done by Ardell Halverson and Steve Merrill to document that. However, the fixed rotation, you have limited flexibility to address both challenges and opportunities, say market opportunities that may come up, and there's plenty of research to indicate that you know, depending upon your rotation, there can be issues with respect to weeds, diseases, insects, and so forth. So that leads us on to the next step, where you take a sort of a dynamic approach to sequencing crops. And here there is no set rotation. What you're doing is that you're looking at your full crop portfolio, and you're making decisions annually based upon externalities and also your management goals. Formally comes from a definition that was developed by Don Tanaka in his 2002 paper in Agronomy Journal, which is a dynamic cropping system is an annual strategy of crop sequencing that optimizes the outcome of production, economic, environmental goals using ecological sound management practices. All right. So, what does this mean? Well, okay. Seems to make really good sense, and it does, because now you have this inherent adaptability to deal with challenges and also to respond to potential opportunities. But I just focus on the two boxes furthest to your right. What it demands of producers is that it demands that they really know their stuff, and also it demands that the research and the extension community is able to either have decision aids or information that's available to these people in real time so they can make decisions quickly. And so there's it takes a special person to be able to implement this, but also you have to have sort of the research and extension, I guess, infrastructure available to be able to give them the information on a timely basis. So it sounds good, but it's not necessarily all that easy to implement. Okay, well, here, 23rd slide, and I'm finally showing some data. All right, what does it mean in terms of yields in the short term? Well, we can kind of step through this. What we have is pretty much cereal-based sequences in 3 years, and we're looking at the wheat yield in the third year, and the cereal-based sequences furthest to the left, and then we increase the diversity, basically integrate a break crop between the spring wheat, or we mix up the crops and are only planting wheat in the third year, and you have two different crops prior to that. And what you see is that where we have the most diverse three-year crop sequences is where we have the highest yield. 29% higher relative to our spring wheat-focused rotation. So that's good news in the short term, but what might this mean in the long term? Well, what's really neat about the research farm is that we have large fields that have been dedicated to fixed rotations. We've got a spring wheat fallow sequence, two fixed rotations, continuous wheat, and also a dynamic rotation. And we have enough phases across the farm to where we're always having spring wheat every year. And so here we're looking at spring wheat yield across a 10-year period. And what's striking here is that if you look at the dynamic cropping system, the average wheat yield is equivalent to that of your spring wheat fallow. But of course, spring wheat fallow, you're only getting crop every other year. But what really stands out is that when the conditions are the most difficult, so 2006, we had just a really difficult year with a drought, the dynamic system is able to produce the most among the annually sequenced crop rotations. So I think that reflects it's a reflection of system resilience, perhaps. It's able to produce the most when times are the toughest. So why is this? Well, precipitation use efficiency, clearly, higher in that dynamic sequence compared to the others. There's also some interesting things going on with respect to the soil. And this is just showing the soil organic carbon in the top 10 centimeters. We measured this in four of the five crop sequences, and what we found was that the five-year fixed rotation, which includes spring wheat, winter wheat, soybean, dry pea, and corn, okay, as well as our dynamic sequence, they have significantly higher soil organic carbon compared to the three-year fixed rotation and, of course, the spring wheat fallow. And interestingly, if you go back and look at the samples that Al Black collected in 1984 when the farm started and compare those soil organic carbon numbers to what we have here, only these two rotations are gaining carbon over time. Not very much, mind you. It's not that great, but at least we're adding to it a little bit. And so that's good news. And that's important because we know from work that was done on Area 4 Farm by Bauer and Black that increasing your soil organic matter content will eventually over time equates to higher grain yield. And that work, I mean, this is this Bauer and Black paper from 94. I don't know, it's Steve, I don't know, it's arguably maybe probably the best known paper that's come out of the farm, you know, it's, this relationship. And it's a sort of a early form of soil ecosystem services, so to speak, relating, you know, a soil parameter to an ecosystem function. So good stuff. So I could go on and continue to talk about things about the farm and other themes that we've had, but I think that what I've showed so far kind of ties into the theme of the symposium with respect to diversification and intensifying systems, and I've kind of touched upon those first two bullets. How do we frame all of this that we've learned in the past and to today? Okay. Well, this is a picture of one of our long-term cropping systems, one that was started in 1993 by Don Tanaka. And what you see in the foreground is a seven-way mix of cover crops. That's sort of a full-season cover crop, sort of a forage crop option. Of course, in the background, you have corn. That's being rotated with soybean. And then way back in the right-hand corner, you see a little bit of a small grain. There. And this somewhat represents the input that we get from our customer focus group. They're really keen on, well, what about these cover crops and what can we do to integrate them within our cropping systems? But I got to have some corn and soybean in my rotation, but I don't want to completely give up my small grains because that's something that I know about and I know it can work. So we take this input, and I think the way we sort of translate it for them is, well, kind of falls under that umbrella of sustainable intensification. How can we put all these things together to intensify our systems within our particular region? And so there are tools to do that, and we've tried to look at it about the last 5 to 6 years, and those tools are cover crops, livestock integration, and perennials. And so these are sort of components, though, of a dynamic cropping system, which we feel has to be sort of the foundation of anything that we develop because of the adaptability it provides and the resilience it also gives us in times of stress. So I'll step through some of the things that we've done with each one of those factors, and first of which is cover crops. And we look at cover crops in a couple of ways. We seed them late summer. This is after we've had dry pea or wheat harvest, and we get right in and we plant those cover crops. That's our late summer cover crop. Then we also have a full season cover crop where we're seeding that typically in May and growing that often for our forage for livestock. But we also have treatments where we don't have livestock, so we can compare that livestock effect. So I have this sort of set up as a matrix, and it sort of shows the different types of studies, both long-term and short-term, that we've done. First off, we'll look at our cover crop matrix study. And this is one that we conducted over 3 years. And I'm showing here the production data for a 7-species cover crop mixture. And what you see is this. First off, it's really those late summer seeded cover crops. You're only going to have cool seasons crops that are going to produce. Your purple top turnips, spring Twitter Kaylee, winter canola. Warm seasons just don't produce. But the bigger thing is that you can see by the size of the pie chart, some years are really good, like in 2008. But in other years, it's a really a crash. We just did not get that one spot of rain in the fall on the farm. And so it becomes kind of risky, I guess. I guess that's one of the things that we've learned from that. It's quite risky in that context. And so But in the times when it does work, say in 2009, 2010, 2011, you can get a benefit from the standpoint of providing forage for livestock. This is a study that is coordinated by Dave Archer, my colleague, where he has planted late summer cover crop following pea and produces enough forage to, at least over these 3 years, provide about 11.5 extra cow days per acre where there was a cover crop. So that's good. Doesn't happen all the time. Some years are tough, like this year in particular is a really tough year, right? but other times it's good. So that livestock then becomes a tool that you might be able to utilize when conditions are favorable. All right, well, okay, so we've looked at late season cover crops. What about the full season cover crop? And this might be considered more of like a forage crop. Well, we've had a study since 1999 that was developed by Don Tanaka and Jim Karn, three-year rotation. And what we're doing is that we're growing these crops, and we cut them, we swath them, and then we feed them during the winter. And so it's and I should point out is that now, I mean, these crops have changed over time. The corn has persisted. The oat pea is now oat and a couple of clovers and I think some understeeded with hairy vetch. And then the triticale sweet clover is now sorghum sedan also with the clover. So we've had a change with the times as we've learned about different forages. But project highlights from this, what we found is that using those swath animal forages will save us money compared to cows that are in the dry lot. No differences in reproductive health, so that's good. And then when you look at soil quality over time, what you see is that, well, there's really no difference between those integrated, that it's an integrated study, and comparing it to a sort of perennial vegetation, sort of our native check. And so that's good. We're not degrading soil quality as a result of this particular system. Perennials, a couple of projects here. Here we're interested in how long do we have to have these perennials in place in order to have sort of a net benefit for subsequent production. Because we think perennials might have a really, can have an important part in our dynamic cropping system. So we have five different perennial treatments that we've seeded along with spring wheat check. And then we come back in subsequent years, 2 years later, and we convert a quarter of them to spring wheat. And gives us phase durations anywhere from 2 to 5 years. And what it does is it allows us to look at, well, yeah, how long do we need to have these crops in? And like, say, for alfalfa, looking at the quotient of continuous spring wheat of the perennial strip to continuous spring wheat, maybe it's 3 years of alfalfa and that's enough. But for our switchgrass and alfalfa mixtures, you might need to have that in for 4 years. And for the intermediate wheatgrass alfalfa, that doesn't really start seeing a boost in productivity until that fifth year. And the reason we included intermediate wheatgrass and switchgrass was the fact that at the time we were really thinking a lot about perennial biofuels, you know, perennial grasses for biofuel production. That kind of cooled off, but still it may in the future come back and be relevant. Finally, one last study. We have been planting corn and soybeans into stands of intermediate wheatgrass and alfalfa, spraying that out and then seeing what's happened. It's a little too early to talk about what the results are, but it's in terms of sort of a soil cover, having continuous soil cover right into planting. We've got that not disturbing the soil. It should be interesting to see how that pans out. So where might this lead? Well, I think that some of these component studies might have some contributions to how we respond to climate change. And certainly we haven't operationalized this and how it might fit in, but you can think of cover crops perhaps potentially being used as we have alterations in the growing season, either the growing season getting longer, or if you have a shorter growing season due to excessive wetness, maybe you can utilize those cover crops to sort of improve soil function or provide a forage. From the perennial standpoint, that might be an issue of soil moisture management or enhancing soil function, because we know that, you know, our soils do improve under perennial conditions. And then, of course, the livestock is integration is just, you just have that enterprise to increase your adaptability to changing conditions. And in the future, we're going to be doing all of this in the context of the LTAR, the Long-Term Agroecosystem Network. We have a study where we're going to compare sort of a large field of sort of an aspirational treatment where we can incorporate some of the things we learned from these component studies towards a business as usual, and we're going to be doing it over the long term. And also, you know, working with people like Dave, who also has a dry land cropping system study, to learn more and to share and generate new experimental data to refine models and so forth. So that's all I had. I'm kind of a whirlwind tour, but thank you so much. I want to certainly my co-workers at the station, we've had a good run and hope we'll continue to have a good run. Dave, John, Don, Steve, Joe, and John. Certainly, we couldn't do this without supportive customers. Our Area 4 supervisors have been great over the years. Really critical for us for them to support our long-term research, and of course all the great staff that we have that requires us to collect that data. They've been great help. So, and thank you all also for coming and listening. So.